Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response midday for the 26th of Tishrei. We want to start with thanking Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hachhauser, and the OU for putting these shiurim online, making them available to you. Today's tshuva is from Shut Mishpat Kohen, from Rav Kook's tshuvot about Eretz Yisrael, issues of the land of Israel, Siman Kuf Yud Tet, response number 119. It's from the 26th of Tishrei of Tuf Reish Ayin Zayin, although he wrote it as Tuf Ayin Zayin Reish, and then the editor of the book like puts in parentheses, it's really Tuf Reish Ayin Zayin, but Tuf Ayin Zayin Reish is Ta'azor, and I'm pretty sure he meant that sometimes some people try to put the calendar year date into a way that signifies some issue and some hope. So the 26th of Tishrei of Tuf Reish Ayin Zayin, what we would call Tuf Reish Ayin Zayin, is 1916. Rav Kook is in London because he got caught in London for much of World War I, and he became the Rav of a shul there. Like, they recognized his greatness, and he became the Rav of a shul, but he was stuck in London. So I could easily imagine he wrote the word Ta'azor, hoping that Hashem would quickly bring World War I to an end. He had received a letter from this man, whoever he is, which is full of Divrei Torah, a long while back, but he'd been very busy, so he's responding now. And it's one of those tshuvot where it appears in a book of responsa, and therefore it fits our project, but it takes a broader halachic concept rather than a specific halachic question. One might argue that I should not be using such tshuvot in our time, except that there are more than a few such tshuvot that I ignore or don't use, and yet they're part of the responsa literature. And I'm looking for a random sample to completely ignore these just because they don't fit our ideas of halacha. Seems to be a problem. So, for example, Shut Shoel Meishiv, Rav Yosef Shoel Natanzon's tshuvot are very often about theoretical halachic concepts rather than specific halachic questions, and their interactions he had with Rabbanim of his time, and their back and forth with the Rabbanim of his time, and he lists various dates on which he did various things, and I often leave them aside or rarely get a chance to use them because they're so theoretical. So in this case, it was an example of one that I thought maybe we could communicate well enough, I could communicate it well enough, that we could productively study it together. So Rav Kook notes that people have this idea that in the Yerushalmi in Sukkah, Perek Gimel Halacha Yud Aleph, there's a discussion there, the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that he's going to eventually get around to, but the discussion there is, let's suppose somebody violates a prohibition that's a curried prohibition without fully realizing what they're doing. A simple example is if one violates Shabbat. So Shabbat violating Shabbat on purpose without witnesses gets the punishment of karet. If somebody unwittingly does it, they don't realize fully, they don't know the halacha well enough, or they forgot the halacha. They forgot this day of Shabbos, they don't realize it's already Shabbos. The way that would easily happen is either they think Shabbos is already over, right, or they don't realize Shabbos already started. That would be an easy way to do it, but there could be other ways. Or they don't remember at the moment that they're doing it that this action is a Shabbat prohibited action. They once do it, they don't realize it anymore. So that would involve a chatat, a korban chatat, bringing a chatat sacrifice. But in that Yerushalmi, there will always hold that it's not enough that it be a karet. It also has to have a lo ta'aseh with it. It has to have a specific prohibition in the Torah. That sounds like, well, how could it not have a prohibition if it doesn't have a karet? And the answer is there are halachic circumstances we can think of where the law, the prohibition, goes away and the karet stays. An example of that would be, we have a principle in halacha, and part of why I like this tshuva is that it's principles that come up. It's a few principles that will come up that we'll deal with that remind us of various broad halachic ideas that come up in lots of situations. So it won't be about a specific case here, but lots of situations that come up. So one of the first principles that we're talking about is the idea of an aseh doche lo ta'aseh. Say doche lo ta'aseh means in their case in halacha, when if you have an obligation, so that can push aside a prohibition. Okay, and that's the general halacha. There's a simple prohibition and there's a simple obligation, and the only way to fulfill the obligation, some people don't think that it has to be the only way, but let's say a way to fulfill the obligation is to violate a prohibition at the same time, they can push it aside. A simple example that comes up is that ordinarily shatnez is you can't have tzemer u'pishtim, you can't have wool and linen together. But techelet only happens in wool strings. Techelet is a wool string kind of a situation. So if you're going to have techelet on your strings and you're going to have a linen garment, that will be shatnez. So the Torah puts those very near each other. That's part of where we understand the idea of aseh d'lochot aseh, is that the aseh of tzitzis, the obligation to wear tzitzis and to put those strings onto our garments, pushes aside the lo ta'aseh, the prohibition of shatnez. There are other examples of it as well, but that's not our topic. So what is our topic is that principle of asei doche lo ta'asei is not applied in halacha to an asei being doche an asei velo ta'asei. There are certain obligations in Judaism and halacha where the Torah not only prohibited something but made a positive commandment to do that or to abide by that prohibition. An example that comes to my mind is observing Yom Tov is generally assumed to be an asei and a lo ta'asei, meaning not to violate Yom Tov. There's a positive commandment of Shvitah, of observing Yom Tov, and then there's prohibitions of not doing malacha on Yom Tov. So in those situations, if an asei were to arise, if a mitzvah obligation were to arise that required violating Yom Tov, it would not apply the principle of asei doche lo ta'asei, because it's not an example of that, because the asei would be trying to be doche the asei velo ta'asei. So when we say that it doesn't work, the question is, how does it not work? Some people will say that it doesn't work because it's just the asei velo ta'asei together, the combination of an obligation and a prohibition, are stronger than an ordinary lo ta'asei, and therefore it stands up against the asei and doesn't get pushed aside. But others held that that's not what happens. What happens is asei doche lo ta'asei still works just fine. The prohibition gets pushed aside, but what's left is an asei to not do that act, and therefore you can't violate it. Meaning, to take the Yom Tov example, the holiday example, there's a positive obligation to observe the Yom Tov by refraining from work, and a prohibition against violating the Yom Tov by doing malacha, which isn't really work, it's creative activity. The asei, whatever it would be, pushes aside the lo ta'asei, and then I think to myself, okay, then I'll do the action. Problem is, I still have a positive obligation to observe the Yom Tov by refraining from such creative activity. That has a couple of ramifications. One of them would be, for example, whether or not the person would get malka. Let's suppose we warn the person, and the two witnesses warn the person ahead of time. The person does it anyway. If the lo ta'asei is still there, you might imagine they would get malka because the lo ta'asei is still there. If you say that asei is not doche, that the obligation can't push aside an asei and a lo ta'asei, it's a question of the strength of it, then the lo ta'asei stays. It also comes up here because, remember, the question was, let's suppose you have, where are we going to find an obligation in a korban, an obligation to bring a sacrifice? So if we say that there's no obligation in a sacrifice unless there's both a lo ta'asei and a karet, it can't be just a karet without the prior prohibition to it, then if the person who violated the karet prohibition, let's say Yom Kippur or Shabbos, if it was in a situation of asei doche lo ta'asei, now ordinarily we do say, and asei it does not push aside, there's actually debate, I think, I mean, I don't know if there's a minchas chinuch about it, but the asei does not push aside a prohibition that has karet to it. It pushes aside a simple level prohibition, but not a karet prohibition. But that's fine. But then when we say it doesn't work, do we mean it doesn't work and it doesn't have any effect? Or do we mean it doesn't work, but it does take away the prohibition and leaves in place the karet? Now, that in a situation where the person doing it on purpose, I wouldn't care that much because the person getting karet, because he did violate the Torah willingly, knowingly, in a situation where there's a karet prohibition. What if he does it unwittingly and you had an asei at hand, so maybe there's no korban there, right? We would say there's no korban because it's an asei being doche, the lo ta'asei, gets rid of the lo ta'asei, maybe, according to some opinions. That would be in machloket. So the Rav Kook says, yeah, so Rashi in Kretot seems to hold that, yes, before you can have a korban, before you can have an obligation to bring a sacrifice for your unwitting violation of the Torah, you would need to have both a lav and a karet, and therefore, if there's no lav, you wouldn't bring the korban. That's why Rashi there goes out of his way to list all 34 of the kretot in the Torah, meaning the prohibitions. There are actually 36 kretot, but two of them are positive commandments, the commandment to bring a Pesach sacrifice and the commandment to circumcise for men to circumcise themselves. So those will be different things. He brings the 34 and he gives you the whole list because those are the ones that can lead to a karet. So that seems to show from the fact that he goes out of the way to list all of the prohibitions that you need to have in order to have a korban, you need to have a lav in there as well. And a source for that would be that we have a principle that the derivation of the idea of karet for these things was midehuksha kol haTorah kula l'avodah zarah. The Torah says, Torah echat yelachem, you should have one Torah, la'aseh bishkaga, and that's after discussing the avodah zarah case, the case of idolatry, of worshipping a power other than Hashem, unwittingly, and that would involve a karet unwittingly, on purpose and deliberately, it would involve a karet. Unwittingly, it would involve a korban chatan. So the Gemara says, "Ma avodah zarah, davar shez do not karet shigta chatan." I've called it a kula. Davar shez do not karet shigta chatan. Just like in the case of avodah zarah, you have where if when it's done on purpose, it gets karet and it obligates a chatat, a sin offering when done unwittingly, without full knowledge of what's going on. That would be the standard in Kol HaTorah Kula as well. It would be standard in other cases as well. Wherever there's a karet, if the action is done unwittingly, you need a chatat. So you can get from there, Rashi would seem to get from there, just like avodah zarah has a lo ta'aseh to it, has a prohibition to it. So to everyone else, it has to have a prohibition to it. That's what Rashi would seem to think, and he's understanding that. Rav Kook is understanding that from the fact that Rashi goes ahead and lists all of the lavin involved. It seems like having a lav be part of it is vital to Rashi's understanding it. But Tosfot in Yevamot, Tet Amud Aleph, says Rav Kook, say that this is actually a matter of debate between Rebbe and Rabbanan. It's a dispute between Rebbe and Rabbanan. Rabbanan, their source for a chatat, for a sin offering, when somebody violates a karet prohibition, is not from that pasuk. Their chatat, their source is from a hekesh to call to the avodah zarah. I'm sorry, they do get from that pasuk, but they only learn it in terms of what's said right there in that pasuk right there. And right there in that pasuk, it doesn't mention the idea of a lav, and therefore there's no reason to assume that we compare, we expand that aspect of an avodah zarah prohibition to other examples of karet. And the reason why you think that is that if you're going to take everything about avodah zarah and just say avodah zarah is the whole model, then you'd have to say, well, avodah zarah, if done on purpose with witnesses, gets punished by skila, gets punished by stoning, if it goes through the whole court procedure and the witnesses do their job right and all those things. But we never think to ourselves that it's only those prohibitions which incur skila, which incur stoning, if done on purpose in front of witnesses, that would eventually require a chatat. So apparently Rabbanan are saying this hekesh, this comparison, the psukim, where the pasuk that closes the discussion of avodah zarah's chatat, of the sin offering brought for unwitting violation of worshipping a foreign power, apparently that hekesh, that comparison, is very limited. It's only limited to what's mentioned there in the psukim. And just like stoning isn't mentioned there in the psukim, so too the existence, the need for a lav, is not mentioned there in the psukim as well. That would be Rabbanan's view. This is what Tosos claim in Yevamot. But Rebbe, he has a different source. Meaning, Rashi seems to take the pasuk to say that just like avodah zarah, so too chatat, and he extends that to a lav as well. Because I think Rashi would say something like, you can't get to a karet without a lav, and therefore the lav is implied, and therefore the reasoning of Tosot that but it doesn't apply to stoning, would be an extra step rather than an incorporated step. Rebbe in Yevamot Tet Amud Aleph offers a gzeirah sheva of aleha aleha. When it comes to the Jewish people sinning in a certain way, it's nodah chatat, the sin that they created, asher chatu aleha, that they sinned by that word aleha. And in the Arayot, it also uses the word aleha, based in Parashat Vayachrei Mot, Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Yudchet, it says, Yishal achotah lo tikach, the three came married two sisters, the galot ervata aleha bechayeha, to uncover her nakedness, meaning the nakedness of one sister with the other sisters, bechayeha, during her lifetime. But there, in fact, the lav is mentioned in the actual pasuk of Cook. As I just pointed out, you can't take a wife and her sister, lo tikach. It says you can't. So there you have the lav in the pasuk. And therefore, according to Rebbe, it would seem to be that, in fact, the lav is necessary to the karet. So the Tosfot have a great proof, says Rav Kook, means lo chashiv b'hadei lav involve kritut gamkin porek ol umefir brit. Tosfot says, you know, in our list of 36 kritut, we don't include somebody who doesn't, who removes the brit, who finds a way to, I'm sorry, porek ol is somebody who refuses to observe mitzvot, and somebody, mefir brit, is somebody who reoperates on themselves to like cover over the brit milah, or megabel panim is somebody who darshens the Torah and first things to the Torah that are wrong and improper. So those two are things where we say about them that they're going to be cut off from life. There are a few gemaras about this, about whether Yom Kippur is mechaper for it, and there's Yerushalmi that says those people don't have a share in the world to come. So Tosa says, why aren't they included in that list? So the answer is, even though Rebbe holds that they are behikareit, as it says in Shavuot, that they are included in being cut off from the people, but there's no law. So that's Tosfos' proof that Rebbe, in fact, holds this way, that a lav is necessary for an obligation. The Karepa Rabbanan don't hold that way. We saw that Rashi seems to think that everybody agrees that way, but now the Rambam also weighs in on this issue. In the first chapter of Hilchot Shigagot, of the laws of unwitting sins and Halacha Bet, he says he also seems to think you need a lot to aseh before you can have a korban. It has to have a specific lav before you can have a requirement of a sacrifice, because he divided the question of why there's no sacrifice for somebody who failed to bring a korban Pesach, or for somebody who failed to get a brit milah, which are two karet problems, issues. Why don't they bring a korban chatat for not having done so? And the other possibility, somebody who's a megadef, somebody who blasphemes, who says terrible things about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that person also theoretically should need a chatat. It's a megadef, also is behikaret, is cutting, being cut off from the people. So the Rambam gives two different reasons, Pesach and Milah, for not giving a korban Pesach or not giving a brit milah. Brit milah is a complicated one because you don't really fully violate the prohibition according to the Rambam until the person passes away without a milah. So I'm not sure when you would bring the korban chatat. But in any case, but for those two, the reason the Rambam gives is they don't bring a sacrifice because we only bring sacrifices for violating a prohibition. Shenemar asher lo te'asena. When it comes to describing the sacrifice, the Torah says somebody does something asher lo te'asena that should not be done. V'amigadev, but for the person who blasphemes, who says bad things and terrible things about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the other Rambam says, Mivnesh ein bo ma'aseh, it's because there's no action involved. Why is that the standard that he gives? So the Rav Kook says, I don't mean the Rav Kook, I just am about to say the, and then Rav Kook, I realize I meant to say Rav Kook. Rav Kook says that the Rambam could obviously have left Pesach and Milah and included them in Megadev because they also don't have a Maaseh, because there's no Maaseh in failing to bring a Korban Pesach. There's no action in failing to perform to have oneself circumcised. So the answer is, and yet he gives the reason of, they don't have a Lo Ta'aseh. So it shows, says Rav Kook, that Rambam also feels that we follow the opinion of Rebbe, that you need a Lo Ta'aseh before you can be obligated in a Korban Chatat. And then he points out, something he pointed out in a previous letter on this topic, that a Gemara in Shabbat, Klal Gadol, says that you're not Chayav in a Chatat, at Sheyishko Belav Vikaret, until you're unaware of, until you're lacking in awareness of both the prohibition and the Karet. Now, you could have just said it meant the Karet, but it says the words, until Sheyishko, that you become unwitting about the Lav and the Karet, which implies that you were amazed about the Lav, even if you were unwitting about the Karet. So, right, that for Reish Lakish would clearly be a lack of a Chatat. Okay, so for Reish Lakish, we've proved our point. So let's just make clear what the example is. Let's suppose somebody knows what they're doing is wrong, but they think it's only a Lav prohibition. And it really is a Karet prohibition. So there, Reish Lakish thinks the person would not bring a chatat because he's not a full shogeg, meaning he knows too much to be a shogeg. We often say shogeg means accidental, but shogeg really means, as I've been saying, being trying to be careful to say along, unwitting, you don't fully realize what you're doing. The question is, what's the level of not fully realizing it? So Reish Lakish holds that if you realize that you're violating the Torah, even though you think you're only violating a plain prohibition, and you're willing to, you know, you're sort of willing to put up with that, you don't realize you're violating the Karet prohibition, that would not involve a chatat. That's not unwitting enough. Rabbi Yochanan there says that you bring a chatat, because Rabbi Yochanan thinks that as long as the person doesn't fully understand what they're doing, including even the severity, they think they're violating Shabbat at a plain prohibition level, and they're really violating at a Karet level, Rabbi Yochanan thinks that's good enough to obligate a chatat. But, says Rav Kook, that's only because the person knows that they're violating the Torah with a lav. But there has to be a lav involved in there, then that he thinks even Rabbi Yochanan would agree to. Now, his correspondent had suggested that there might be a difference there about Pesach and those examples, because Pesach doesn't have a lav at all. Whereas in the case that they had been talking about, which was, let's remember, an aseh doche lo ta'aseh that has a karet to it. So one option is that the aseh still manages to push aside the lo ta'aseh. It still gets rid of the lo ta'aseh. There's just a karet left over. The correspondent suggested maybe there that's enough of a lav being present that the obligation on a chatat would still occur, meaning that the pushing, meaning when there is no lav to begin with, that's where you'd say, no, it needs to have a lav. But when there was a lav and it just got pushed aside, they say maybe. So Rav Kook says it's a reasonable claim to make, but he thinks it's more reasonable. Rav Kook thinks it's more convincing to say that since Rebbe says the lav is necessary for the korban, once you say there's a lav in this program, it would make sense to say not that there was upon a time was a lav here, because lav's not here now. When the person violates it, there's no lav. And if Rebbe is requiring a lav as part of the violation to record, so obligate a korban, a sacrifice, it makes more sense to say the lav has to be present at the time that he's violating the prohibition that would, in fact, incur the obligation in the sacrifice. And for that, Rebbe Shlomo Kish's view that if you're, a shogeg who requires, Rebbe Shlomo Kish requires you to be a shogeg about the lav and the karet, that would seem to say that the lav still plays a role in the actual prohibition. Then he points out another distinction that you might have drawn. You might have argued that even according to those opinions that say that when there's an assay and a lota assay together, that in fact what the assay does is it strengthens the lota assay, and therefore the prohibition, and therefore the other assay doesn't push aside even the lota assay. You can still get malko, you can still get lashes for violating, right? That was the discussion we had earlier today about that question. When we say that an obligation pushes aside a prohibition, but does not push aside a combined obligation prohibition, did we mean that the prohibition still gets pushed away, but the obligation is left over? If we meant that, then there would be no lashes because the person who violates it is only violated an assay. Or did we mean to say that an assay, once a prohibition has been combined by the Torah with an obligation, then it creates a stronger combination, and that strong combination can't be pushed aside by the obligation, and therefore there would be lashes. That's what we said back there. Rav Kook says, but you could argue that when it comes to a karet situation, you wouldn't get into that situation, that discussion. Because you might argue, you could reasonably argue, says Rav Kook, that with the karet, when you have a lota say with a karet, which also we say, the obligation can't push aside a prohibition that has a karet punishment attached to it, presumably because it's stronger. And that's fine. But there, says Rav Kook, there's more reason to think that the assay still does push aside the lota assay, still does push aside the prohibition, leaving only a karet. And since we are saying that you don't really get a korban, you can't really have a sacrifice, a chatat, without there being the present both a lota assay and a prohibition and a karet, then it would mean that you wouldn't have it in that situation. And the reason for that, says Rav Kook, is because you have the example of Korban Pesach and Milah, the Paschal sacrifice and the Milah, where we say there's a karet there and yet there's no chatat because you need the lav. So that would seem to show that a lav with a karet is not as banded a group as an assay and a lota assay. Meaning when it came to the obligation, the mixed obligation prohibition, the double obligation prohibition, there were two opinions. One was the assay pushed aside the prohibition anyway. The other one was, no, the combination is so strong that it doesn't get pushed aside. In a karet situation, Rav Kook is saying, there's less reason to think that the combination is so strong that the lota assay doesn't get pushed aside, because we know that the karet can come even without a lota assay. So there's no reason to think that they become inextricably linked. It strengthens the situation such that the obligation doesn't permit doing it, but it doesn't do it in such a way that we would think that the lota assay doesn't go away, such that there could still be a chatat. There's a couple of, now, that's the bulk of the content of the tshuva. There's a couple of side points that he brings up at the end to sort of clean up the discussion, some of which I think are interesting, therefore I'll suggest some of them. One is, there's a Yerushalmi in Shavuot that the correspondent brought up in the third chapter of Shavuot in Halacha Dalet, that if somebody takes an oath not to eat matzah and then eats matzah on Pesach night, the girsa of Tosfot, the version of Tosfot is that that person is chayav, they're going to be liable for violating the oath. So that would be a situation where you have an assay, the obligation of eating matzah, trying to push aside the lota assay of the oath. But it happens to be that the girsa of many other people, of the Rif and the Ran and the Ramba and the Ramban and the Baal HaMor and the Rashba, is not chayav, they're obligated, but asur. You can't eat matzah on Leilei Pesach, and the Ritzva clearly has that girsa, and therefore the other Tosfos who have the other girsa, it seems to be that maybe they're not involved in that situation. They were chayav when they didn't really mean to think about whether the person is liable or not, because really that should be an asei l'doche lota asei situation. It should at least not be liable for the lashes, or it would prove, because it would prove the point, and those people don't hold that way about it. Or you could say that there it's different because he has the possibility of being nish'al al shvuato. He could have gone to a rabbi and said to the rabbi, I didn't notice that it was going to get in the way of my keeping the obligation, am I fulfilling the obligation to eat matzah on Pesach, and the rabbi would have been matir the neder for him. So that creates a situation where we could say that you didn't have to violate the prohibition to fulfill the obligation. And usually we say, or almost often we say about a say lota, so maybe all this time, that it's only when then that's the only opportunity, the only way to fulfill the obligation is to violate the prohibition. So you might say in tzitzis, I don't understand, you can make a garment of all wool and then put wool tzitzis on it with tchelet, with the dye, which we think of as a blue dye, onto the tzitzis, and you'd never have to violate the prohibition. But that's not a possibility because the Torah obligated tzitzis also on linen garments. If there's an obligation to the gun, then linen garments have no way to have tzitzis other than by having shtatnis. So you'll have an asei doche lo taasei, the obligation pushes aside the prohibition only where it's necessary. And in the case of an oath not to eat matzah, it's not absolutely necessary because you do hataras tadarim. You could get the neder removed by a chacham by saying. So that would be that would answer up that question, and that reminds us of a couple of issues. In asei doche lo taasei, that the whole principle only applies when that's the only way to fulfill the obligation, and therefore that's when it pushes aside. And also reminds us of the question of hataras tadarim as always being out there as an option, therefore saying that it's not considered impossible otherwise. There's also a Maharami Lublin that I don't want to get into the full discussion of it, but the Maharami Lublin thinks that when it comes to Shabbos, there's no asay, there's no obligation of the malachos of Shabbos, which would theoretically mean that nasay can push aside the malachos of Shabbos, except that most of them are karet, they're too strong a prohibition to be put aside, to be pushed aside. Except that the Torah, the Gemara never actually says the reason why you don't say asay doche lo taasei regarding Shabbos is that Shabbos is an issue that has karet, is a prohibition that has karet. So it could be, says Rav Kook for the Maharami Lublin, that that's because there is this one prohibition of Shabbat that's considered a plain prohibition, which is the prohibition of mechamer. Mechamer is when an animal has something on it and you tell the animal to go. That's a prohibition. That's a violation of Shabbat. You're not allowed to make your animal go and carry loads on Shabbat, but it's a plain prohibition, not a karet prohibition. Therefore, since the discussions of asei doche lo taasei wanted to cover all of Shabbat, it didn't use that reasoning because there was no karet in that situation. Then there was a case of gevila in the Yerushalmi. And does it, I don't want to get into the whole case of gevila, but in trying to explain gevila's position, where some would have said maybe he holds that asei is doche lo taasei v'asei, and that would be an odd thing to hold, because we think that generally we think that an obligation can't push aside both an obligation and prohibition. So Rav Kook suggests that Gevila might have held that in fact an asei does push aside an obligation and prohibition, but only an obligation and prohibition of kohanim that applies only to kohanim, because it's eina shaveh bakol. It's not something the Torah applied to everybody. So if it's a rule the Torah didn't apply to all the Jewish people, that makes it a weaker rule as a rule. It's a more narrow, limited rule, and therefore you can imagine that in that situation, an asei, even an asei that's not applying to everybody, it just means the whole calculus is different. You could argue that gevila would hold. It's not that we would hold this halacha, but you can imagine that gevila would hold. Once I see an asei and a lo taasei of kohanim, those are weaker, narrower, less universal problems that the Torah has with certain kinds of actions. And therefore, even though the asei too is a narrow one, it could be that in the realm of kohanim, in the narrow, restricted realm of kohanim and their obligation prohibitions, an asei would in fact push it aside. Although there, he suggests another option, because the case that they were talking about was whether or not you could push aside an asei or lo taasei, whatever it was, I don't remember the exact example, but in order to give a birchas kohanim. But there you could argue that birchas kohanim, in fact, is an obligation that is shaveh bakol, that does apply to everybody, because you could argue, and this is a debate among the poskim, as to whether there's an obligation only on kohanim to give the bracha, or there's also an obligation on regular, ordinary Jews, the rest of Jews, to hear the bracha, and to be mitbareh, to accept the bracha. And if you hold that way, then you have an asei that shaveh bakol, an obligation that applies to all Jews, the obligation to have the bracha of the kohanim be given by the kohanim to the Jewish people. That applies to all Jewish people. And that could push aside an asei that lo taasei that applies only to kohanim. So that would be a way to read that sugya. So fundamentally what you have in this discussion back and forth, and I've skipped a lot of things, and I take these even though I can't do them full justice, because I can at least hopefully do them partial justice, and that will be good enough for us to feel that we've accomplished something and had some interaction with Rav Kook on these issues. The Rav Kook takes on these broad halakhic ideas that have come up periodically in various situations, such as, you know, what kind of tzitzis can you wear, what kind of materials can you use, and things like that. The concept of asei lo taasei in some of its ramifications. And what we saw was that asei is generally doche el lo taasei. It's doche a plain prohibition. The example that we used was mixing wool and linen when it came to tzitzis, and the obligation of tzitzis pushes aside the prohibition of shatnez of that, but it doesn't apply to other kinds of aseh lotas, to more complicated lotases. One easy example is a lotase that is combined with an aseh, and the question there became, when it combines with an aseh, is it that the aseh still pushes aside the lotaseh, but there's an aseh left over, or does the combination form a stronger barrier to being pushed aside such that both are still there? That becomes relevant to the question of a lota aseh that has a karet prohibition, punishment attached to it, because there would ordinarily be a korban chatat. The question was, does an aseh push aside the lota aseh such that if we hold that a lota aseh is necessary for the chatat, there wouldn't be a chatat? So these were some of the issues that we had a chance to see today in terms of aseh lota aseh, and the question of shavu bekol and how it applies to Kohanim, and some things that Rav Kook taught us for today, the 26th of Tishrei. Have a great day.